the 1960s, spies and spy fiction have been a regular feature of television schedules, including on British TV. My guest in this episode is Joseph Oldham, author of Paranoid Visions, Spies, Conspiracies and the Secret State in British Television Drama, published by Manchester University Press. And he joins me today to talk about notable British spy shows, including Callan, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, Bugs, Spooks and The Night Manager. This discussion was recorded before the death of John le Carré, so we don't mention that. Otherwise, I hope you enjoy. What was the entry point for you researching television spy series?
Well, that's kind of a long answer and a short answer, really. I mean, this book comes out of my PhD research. So that was a PhD I did from 2010 to 2013. I was doing that in the film and television studies department at the University of Warwick. And, when you kind of study television there, there's often a lot of sort of interesting kind of, not just sort of doing analysis of the shows themselves, but kind of digging into the sort of institutions and the production history and so on. And there's a degree to which I was just kind of looking for a case study, and I started thinking in terms of genre, and became very kind of drawn to this thing about spies and conspiracies. And so this is something that kind of, goes back kind of right through my life, really. It sort of goes back to sort of my childhood in the 90s, when the British television just seemed to be kind of full of all these sort of repeats of old spy shows. You'd watch like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and The Avengers and Captain Scarlet and so on. And then they made Bugs, which was a new show in the same style. And I kind of loved all this stuff. I really liked it. But even kind of as a very young person, not really knowing much about history, I remember sort of having a sense that these were old shows. The first ones I mentioned, these are things from like the 60s and the 70s. And so I think I sort of got into the genre and also kind of got into the history at the same time. I have, I think, the dimmest memory of the collapse of the Soviet Union. So I kind of had a sense of these kind of programs sort of fitting into that sort of early era that was no longer entirely with us. I also got into Doctor Who around the same time and got into kind of reading a lot about that. And that was a sort of fan community that had a particularly rich body of kind of research into the production history and into the kind of making of, I think, much more than a lot of other kind of popular series. So that kind of got me really interested in the things that went on in sort of production offices and behind the scenes and in all British television institutions. There is, a lot to read and a lot to sink your teeth into there. And I think it then sort of carries on into the 2000s when I watched Spooks kind of all the way through on its original transmission from 2002 to 2011. And I think that was my first sort of taste of, as it were, sort of serious spy fiction that was sort of topical and about issues ripped from the headlines and about kind of the ethics of this sort of thing. And I remember being a bit sniffy when it first came on, but actually being kind of won over and actually finding it very kind of absorbing. And it was a very sort of compelling show for its time. I rewatched the first series. There was an online watch along in the first lockdown, and I went and sort of chatted about it online with various sort of complete strangers, and I was like, yeah, this does stand up. This is actually very kind of, you can still feel the kind of freshness. So I think that sort of made me think about the spy genre as something that actually kind of, could connect to sort of history as it unfolded around you, as opposed to kind of like old Cold War history. And I think maybe the last part of the puzzle was doing my master's at the University of Warwick, when we did Edge of Darkness, the 1980s conspiracy thriller, which I also talk about in the book. And you know, that was actually, you know, we watched the entire thing as part of one of the postgraduate modules, and that got me sort of very into this more paranoid approach towards the same sorts of themes about state secrecy and so on, and how you could then sort of link it up to 1980s politics and Thatcherism and so on. So I think, and there's a very good little a book from the BFI Classics range by John Cockey on Edge of Darkness that was very, very kind of influential on my approach, that I think really sort of does that kind of lovely mix of sort of aesthetic analysis of the program and sort of production analysis and contextual analysis. And it was all, my PhD almost came from a kind of desire to sort of do that, but on a grander scale about more things, and almost, you know, chart the path from the Avengers to Edge of Darkness to Spooks, and how this sort of idea of state secrecy actually took all in television drama, sort of took all these different forms and seemed actually quite different in various ages.
Yeah, I think one thing that you start the book right at the very start, drawing this kind of comparison between the BBC and the security services. Why did you start the book with the comparison between BBC and security / secret service?
I opened the book specifically with two anecdotes that I thought were quite interesting. Two anecdotes that were sort of several decades apart and yet seemed almost sort of identical. First of all, there's the story that during the making of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, the production team were consulting John le Carré, the author of the original novel, about how to, you know, how they could, you know, create this kind of really authentic depiction of MI6 on the screen. And he was apparently just sitting there in this BBC building and said, well, to be honest, it's not actually unlike the BBC. The BBC, you could do a lot worse than, you know, use the BBC as a model. And so, I mean, that had some kind of authority because le Carré had worked in intelligence in the early 1960s. So, you know, knew what he was talking about. I found that story. That story is in Gene Seaton's History of the BBC during that period, and it's also in Adam Seizman's le Carré biography. So it's a bit of a kind of fun story that is often told about the making of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. But my own sort of research, my own discovery, found that there's an almost identical story from the creation of Spooks, where David Wollstonecraft, who was the writer who developed the idea and is credited as creator and was kind of the main writer of the first series, at least. He'd been tasked by Kudos Film and Television to create this precinct drama about MI5. And although they did have some help from people, sort of ex-intelligence service employees who were sort of working in the corporate sector, I do not believe they had actual advice from MI5. But he was kind of thinking, how can I, come up with a depiction of MI5 that sort of feels plausible, that draws from something I can find out about? And he kind of looks around the BBC and he's like, yeah, the BBC, that could be a good model for how I'm depicting MI5. But what kind of struck me about this is that even though it's the same story, in many ways, the BBCs you're talking about are quite different BBCs, you know. So the late 70s BBC is, in many ways, it's hard to generalize, but it's almost like your stereotype of sort of auntie Beeb, this sort of place. I mean, I always kind of imagine it like the sort of rooms you see on display in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, all these kind of musty offices and people smoking pipes and stuff. I mean, maybe that's an exaggeration, but it's definitely this very, it's before the kind of market reforms that impact on the BBC in the sort of 80s and 90s. So it's this very sort of musty old public service organization with its own sort of internal culture of sort of BBC people, whereas the BBC of the early 2000s, when David Wollstonecraft is developing Spooks, is this much more kind of glossy, slick place, you know, kind of much more attention to sort of branding, and I think there's a sort of Spooks sort of makes great play with this sort of open plan office space where all the spies are sort of working together. And I think, you know, you can kind of look at the photos of the BBC sort of post 90s, and that's very much the sort of the image you get of it.
Do you think there's something specific about British television and the way it's structured that makes it really suitable for spy series? A lot of the films, the programs that you mention in the book, particularly the big ones and the ones you've mentioned so far, in terms of Tinker, Sailor, Soldier, Spy, Edge of Darkness, and also you've got a really good chapter on Callan as well. All of them made the leap to the big screen.
That's true.
And I wonder whether there's a kind of difference in the way that the big screen spy adventures, maybe because maybe they have to have an emphasis on action or movement, whereas the slow burning nature of something like Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy is maybe more suited to the serial.
Yeah, so there's something in the kind of serial format. I mean, so with Tinker, Tailor and Edge of Darkness, you have these you know, these kind of contained serials of 6 and 7 episodes. And so that is your story. It's not this kind of endless extension of ideas you get in with like things like Homeland, sort of in more recent times. Callan is a series that did run for 4 different series before it then got turned into the film. I mean, of those 3, you could also add Spooks. I mean, they made a movie out of that in the end. And I think kind of in most of those cases, with the exception of Tinker Tailor, the film is generally regarded as a bit of a disappointment comparative to greater or lesser extent. Like, people generally prefer the television series. I think Tinker Tailor is the only one where there's actually a kind of meaningful sort of debate about that and the lack of a clear answer. So I think all these benefit from a certain degree to which the television serial or series can allow the idea to unfold more slowly, can allow more character development over time. I think there's something about the lower budgets on the whole almost kind of force this more sort of cerebral, thoughtful style. There's less of an interest in kind of spectacle to sort of fill up the screen. So the Callan film in particular, that's actually, they basically did a remake of the pilot episode. There was a pilot episode in 1967, then that got turned into a book, and then when they did the film in 1974, they adapted the book, so effectively remade the pilot, which I think was kind of a silly idea. I think they should have just added a new story on because they had the same cast. But you get this thing where what was basically just like a sort of 50-minute story is sort of weirdly padded with these kind of action scenes that just don't really work and don't really fit in. So that's maybe the most... the least satisfying.
Callan is one of those 70s television adaptations, film adaptations, that simultaneously is one of my favourite films and also a massive disappointment at the same time. The Rising Damp movie was very, very similar in that they just remade episodes. And it's an irritating decision, but I also love the movie as well. I think Callum's different from those other ones, of course, because it's not a serial, it's a series.
Yeah.
I think so, and so like it's almost in many respects, it's repeating the same kind of episode every week. And I sort of think that that pilot episode is called the Magnum for Schneider, I think it's called.
Yes.
Is almost the quintessential episode because he's brought out of retirement. He doesn't want to do it. He looks for a reason to commit this assassination, and at the end he kind of fucks over his own service. And then there's a file put out on him right at the very end of the episode. He's like, there's nowhere else for the series really to go apart from kind of
do
that over and over again. I mean, and you get some fantastic episodes after that. I think that's really kind of why it's different from Edge of Darkness, why it's different from Tinker. It's not got that serial format. Talking about Callan, could you tell us a little bit about the series? Just maybe could you, just for the kind of listeners, if they're not familiar with Callan, can you describe the series for us? And then also talk a little bit about the use of close-ups, because in the chapter on Callan, you make a particular point about the use of close-ups in that series.
Okay, so Callan is a series that starts in 1967, runs to 1972. It is, in brief, about this government assassin called David Callan, played by Edward Woodward in his breakout role. And it's a very interesting series because of just how kind of downbeat and aggressively cynical it is. So it pops up right, you know, it launches in like 1967, the Summer of Love, and is just completely against all the kind of stereotypes of that era. So it's this very kind of gloomy show about this man who is an expert at killing people, and doesn't really like the fact that he's an expert in killing people, and would rather sort of do something else with his life. But his skills are just so excellent that he's continually sort of manipulated and forced by the state to do all this kind of dirty work on their behalf. It's interesting in particular because it's got a lot, it has a lot about the kind of the class politics of Britain kind of built into it. So Callan is sort of meant to be this kind of lower middle class, maybe a bit kind of working class sort of character, and all the kind of the various sort of bosses who manipulate and betray him are always these kind of real sort of upper crust establishment types. He has this rival character called Toby Mears, who's this kind of slick public school boy who kind of really kind of relishes all the kind of dirty work and doesn't have the kind of reluctance. So there's a kind of a tension there. I mean, there's all sorts of tensions, and that's kind of why the series is so interesting, and why, even though it is ultimately a kind of spy show, which has, you know, a new case and a new mission every week, it's got all these kind of lovely sort of simmering character tensions that you just don't really find in other programs of this era, and that are really kind of fresh and intricate. I think it stands up really well. I think it's really well written and really well acted in ways that still come across. In terms of kind of its aesthetics, then, the point with Callan is that it was done largely in the studio in this kind of multi-camera videotape style of recording, which is kind of, and it's sort of very hard to kind of get into all the complexities of this stuff if you're not sort of into it already, because there are some different ways of making programs at that time, and a lot of the kind of more commercially successful spy shows designed for the international markets, so things like The Avengers and Danger Man, were shot on 35mm film and kind of edited. They were shot single camera and then sort of created in the edit. So they're, you know, for their time, very kind of slick and polished. But Callan sort of made in the style of production that is generally used for comparatively lower budget, more modestly resourced programs that might be sold abroad, but they're not really kind of designed for that in the same way. So it's the less prestigious style of production, and in many ways the kind of cruder style, you know. So it's multi-camera recording. Much of the kind of cuts between the cameras is live vision mixing. So it's the mode of production that, to put it very simply, kind of is more obviously descended from live television. But I kind of think that's, in a way, that's where it draws its strength. I mean, I talk about the opening scene of series one, episode one, so not the pilot, the actual start of the first series. And I kind of talk a lot in the book about just how the series, generates lots of tension from, I think, these kind of continuous performances that unfold in the studio, and how the camera really kind of gets in close to people's faces and really kind of looks at, you know, their expressions and really communicates the psychology of the characters through that. I mean, it's something that people say about, what's often seen as the first, in inverted commas, golden age of US television in kind of the early 50s, when you had those various sort of plays broadcast from New York, and the actor's studio, and all those actors like James Dean and Marlon Brando were sort of in the television studio, and the camera was really getting in close to their face and getting their sort of acting kind of live to millions of people. It's a sort of similar thing to that. It's sort of that same tradition a decade later. I mean, the classic kind of spy posing with a gun thing. I mean, think like the James Bond gun barrel, where it's, you know, he's sort of standing and pointing the camera at the audience, and you sort of see his whole body. I think Callan's got this kind of small screen thing where, I mean, when I was looking at that opening episode, I was struck by how often he seemed to be kind of holding the gun very close to sort of his face or to other people's faces. You get these facial close-ups where the gun is kind of visible, and there's always this kind of love-hate relationship with the gun sort of right up close.
I suppose it moves away from the kind of naturalism of it. There's a kind of unnaturalness, I think, to Callan. On the one hand, you've got the performances often unfolding in real time, which gives them a sense of naturalism and realism. But then when you go into the close-ups and when you've got these artificial poses where, it, you know, in terms of the framing and in terms of the blocking, you have to have the gun right up close to the face to emphasize a particular point. It's got something quite unusual about it. There's an expressionistic element about Callan, which is sometimes missing in some of the other spy series and those kind of adjacent spy series like Special Branch.
So it was, the first series was made by ABC, and then following kind of rejigging the franchise, it's made by Thames Television, the remaining series. And they made it in Teddington Studios, where I understand they kind of, ABC, who, you know, had that studio in the 60s, had developed kind of special sort of expressionistic techniques. They developed much more interesting use of the camera and much more interesting use of the lighting than was particularly typical for drama of the time. So I think some of that kind of that ends up, you know, appearing in Callan and used very well to sort of communicate Callan's kind of somewhat noir psychological drama very nicely, I think.
So a little bit later, obviously Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and Jean Le Carré is a really important figure, I think, in the in television spy genre. Just recently, The Night Manager was very popular, for example. But can you tell us why you think that Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy was such a key moment in the development of the television spy genre?
I think there's a number of reasons why I think it's this massive turning point. What's a good order to talk through them? I think it's, first of all, I think it's where the BBC first comes up with something that's quite unprecedented that you've not really seen on ITV. Because the argument in the book, so the first two chapters focus entirely on ITV shows from the 60s and 70s. And the point I kind of make is that although the BBC did do some spy shows before Tinker Tailor, they're mostly kind of, to some extent, imitations of things that ITV were doing. So ITV does, there's the various different ITV companies, but ITV does The Saint, and the BBC responds with The Third Man. ITV does The Avengers, the BBC responds with Adam and Lives. ITV does Callan, the BBC responds with something called Codename, which is now completely lost. So there's a sense in which the BBC, for over the 60s and 70s, I think are constantly kind of lagging behind ITV and mostly just seem a bit uncertain how to respond to this genre. It's often seen as a very kind of populist commercial genre. I think they're, you know, in its very public service kind of heyday, the BBC is a bit like, should we do this? We don't know. And whenever they do try, it's maybe a little bit half-assed. Tinker Tailor, I think, is where the BBC just does something that you can put in the spy genre that's just unlike anything that anyone's done before, including ITV. So I think it's quite interesting that, and then in a sense that their success with that then paves the way for things like Edge of Darkness and Spooks and so on, this kind of greater confidence of this sort of material that grows later on. I think it's a major turning point for its use of this sort of closed form serial narrative. So a story that kind of unfolds over seven episodes, then reaches a sort of definite ending. You don't really get that before. I mean, it's a form that we sort of take for granted now because they've been kind of making all sorts of shows like that for decades now. It's not quite the first. I mean, there's some odd little things that if you kind of look around, but I think these Tinker Tailor is kind of the first really sort of major one that kind of captures the attention. And I think it also invests the genre with this kind of prestige that you haven't really got before. So it was made by people who actually mostly worked in the classic serial tradition. So the producer, Jonathan Powell, and various other people associated in production had, you know, done the adaptations of The Mayor of Casterbridge, adapted by Dennis Potter, and all sorts of other stuff along those lines. They go on to do The Barchester Chronicles, adapted by Alan Plater. So this is the classic novel tradition. So this is almost like the most sort of prestigious people in television doing gasp a spy story. So that kind of gives it this quality gloss that isn't really there for any kind of television spy productions prior to 1979. They get Alec Guinness, this sort of legend of stage and the big screen, who's sort of barely done any television at that point. That's like a major kind of thing that imparts this prestige upon it.
What is it about A Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy that you really respond to? For me, it's the characterization, I think, the whole mood that it evokes. And I think in some respects, it's a little bit like, again, you've already talked about there's the aesthetic link to the BBC, but also how it's about these public school figures who were put in, you know, almost kind of like taken straight from university and placed into important institutions in the same way that I imagine the BBC at the time was led by public school figures placed to work in the BBC and end up becoming influential in this big public institution. Part of that is, again, related to the social class aspect of it. There's a moment in the television series where they're talking about one character chiding another one for going to a red brick university, for example.
I was going to mention that, yeah.
and so Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy itself is all about class, even though it's minus most of those lower middle class and working class figures. Although you do have the Huel Bennett character, who's a lower middle class, working class character, does the kind of dirty work.
Well, in a sense, I mean, his character is kind of the Callan character, but by kind of what Tinker Tailor is and what John le Carré is interested in, he's massively kind of, he's got a much smaller role in the narrative. Tinker Tailor is sort of much more interested in the officer class. So it's similar, a similar world to Callan, but essentially taking a different perspective. It's aligning more with the privilege.
I don't know of the social class of the actors who perform in the television series, but in the movie, it's interesting who they cast in the particular roles. The Huel Bennett role is played by Tom Hardy in the movie, who's got a far more blue-collar a persona than somebody like Benedict Cumberbatch, who plays the Peter Gwillem character, played by Michael Jayston in the series, who is obviously more of a public schoolboy type.
I mean, there's a lot going on there. I mean, there's a very interesting book that's come out by Toby Manning on John le Carré's stuff, which actually really digs into the class politics of the book in ways that sort of maybe think a little bit less of it somehow. It does have this odd way of having these quite sort of violent working class characters like Ricky Tarr and like the character of Fawn, who's kind of like this sort of odd jobs guy, and they're sort of pushed right to the fringes of the narrative, which nonetheless kind of does rest on violent acts that they perform and their willingness to go out and sort of do the dirty work, so that sort of Smiley doesn't have to. And Gwillem is definitely, you know, meant to be somebody who comes from more of the privileged world, more of the sort of public school world. And it's kind of presented, and I think this probably comes across more in the book, where you do get more insight into the characters' thinking. But it's kind of part of what's supposedly gone wrong with the politics of the intelligence service, that Gwillem has been kind of shoved to the margins and left to look after this division of scalp hunters. He's got to kind of get down with those nasty, violent common people, instead of sort of like his more rightful inheritance in the upper class. Yeah,
that is interesting, because I always got the sense even though there's an element of that in the television adaptation and the movie adaptation, there's also a sense Gwillem's got a kind of he cares for his scalp hunters as well, right? That's the way I always interpreted it. There's a certain amount of care rather than complete disdain. And I think maybe that's something in the performances of Jayston and Cumberbatch as well. You know, he's got to maintain a professional relationship with them, but there's also a sense of care as well. Although, of course, they do double-cross Ricky Tarr quite badly in the story as well. They use him and use him quite badly. How does Spooks and Bugs compare to what had gone before?
I mean, I don't talk that much about Bugs in the book. I kind of wish I had, actually. If I'd had like another chapter to play with, I think Bugs would have been in, and I've written an article about it that can be found elsewhere on the internet. Bugs is very interesting because It comes up in the mid to late 90s. And it's this very self-conscious attempt to go back to all these kind of sort of goofy kind of pop spy shows of the 60s, like The Avengers and The Man from U.N.C.L.E. It's a very sort of self-conscious attempt to revive that in the 1990s, but to kind of wed it to all these technological developments, the dot-com boom. So its protagonists are these, you know, three investigators who have their own sort of private security company, and they get involved in, you know, dealing with all this kind of corporate espionage with kind of low-level science fiction scenarios. And it's all kind of, it's all very kind of silly good fun and sort of deliberately very shallow. I've found it kind of very interesting to talk about, though, because I think it, in many ways it is, for all its being this kind of self-conscious nostalgia piece, it's also actually bringing on all this kind of new stuff, these new storytelling techniques for the digital age. So it's full of all this stuff about surveillance technology and sort of instant communications that kind of drive the narrative, that then sort of get taken up by more serious spy shows like Spooks. It's there's a thing in kind of a lot of modern spy fiction that you almost just take for granted now, that characters just sort of have kind of hidden microphones and earpieces on their person. So people in wildly different locations can just communicate with each other instantly and hold entire conversations. And it's this major kind of shift in how these narratives are told. And, you know, you just don't really have that in the 60s and 70s. And Bugs really, I think, is just one of the maybe the earliest example of that. And this, so you get this very, just formally, this very interesting kind of collapse of space, which I think is very, very interesting. It's also interesting as a case of the BBC doing what, the BBC screening and commissioning a spy show that's almost kind of aggressively commercial in some ways. It's very sort of, you know, it's made by an independent production company. It's sort of celebrating all this kind of corporate world. It's all kind of filmed around the London Docklands when that was all, you know, shiny new redevelopment and stuff. And I did a paper on it at a conference, and somebody came up to me afterwards and sort of said to me, I loved watching Bugs as a child, but you've shown me it was naked Thatcherite propaganda. And it possibly is in a way. And it's the sort of thing that the BBC, I think, just wouldn't have done a few decades ago. Their great earliest spy show is something like Tinker Tailor, which is still very, very interested in public service and the product of a public service broadcaster. Whereas Bugs, you get the kind of BBC sort of both on screen and off screen getting much more into this kind of commercial mentality, which sort of paves the way for Spooks. So to move on to Spooks, which I do talk about quite a lot in the book, it was an interesting experience because I started my PhD in 2010 when there was like one more season of Spooks to be broadcast. So when I started the PhD, Spooks was still an ongoing concern. By the time I finished and then was writing out the book, Spooks had become kind of historical and feels not quite totally forgotten, but it feels like it's sort of maybe in a bit of a lull and then might get revived as a nostalgia piece later or something. And Spooks is very interesting as this kind of, I thought it was useful to have it at the end of the book because it feels like this kind of hybrid of a whole load of things that went before. It's kind of got something of the office intrigues of Tinker Tailor. It's got something of the kind of interesting counterterrorism, which I look at in sort of 70 shows like Special Branch. It's got a bit of the kind of paranoia of Edge of Darkness, maybe a little bit lower in the mix. And it's got that interesting kind of digital technology of Bugs. So it kind of draws the themes together, but mixed in with certain sort of trends of British television in the early 2000s. So it's kind of a precinct drama at a time when, you know, there was this kind of huge abundance of kind of police shows and hospital shows and so on. So it's clearly, I think, trying to be a kind of slightly more kind of exceptional upmarket version of that kind of idea. And it's sort of bringing in, there's sort of aspects of a kind of post-90s lifestyle drama. It's sort of Some of the way the character is treated sort of feels a bit like it's in the tradition of this life. It's got a lot going on with it in Spooks. There just seems loads to talk about. And of course, it kind of connects to all those sort of politics of the war on terror and so on.
Did it have much to say about the war on terror, which I guess was... What years was Spooks? What year was that produced?
Okay, its broadcast goes from 2002 to 2011, and it was commissioned before 9/11. Four episodes were written before 9/11, so the bulk of the first series is largely conceived without the sort of war on terror framework. As it were. It's much like kind of in the US, you had 24 and Alias actually made their debut before 9/11. So there's this curious, there's this really strange phenomenon where there's this interest in doing kind of this backlash against the X-Files and this desire to do spy series that are a bit more sort of in the real world and a bit more topical that then gets this kind of, that then sort of get this kind of, this entire sort of geopolitical narrative just sort of falls into everybody's laps. I think the thing about Spooks, I mean, it's doing the war on terror, and it's, you know, and they do sort of squeeze all these references to 9/11 into the first series, even to the scripts that had already been written. And it's hard to say because it does change a bit over the course of the run, and it's also written by loads of different writers, and it's hard to really say anything coherent about the politics of Spooks because it's just sort of all over the place, and you sort of sense different writers are just bringing in different viewpoints or whatever's kind of expedient for the narrative of the week. You know, so you've got some episodes where the show sort of seems to sort of think that torture is okay in the heat of the moment, and other episodes where it's much more aghast at the idea, and it's hard to really kind of discern any sort of coherent politics from it. They do state things in some of the promotional interviews and the interviews on the DVD about how the fact that it was a show on the BBC meant they had to be careful how they represented people and so on, and be very sensitive. And there's a certain way in which, As a series with a kind of case of the week format, it is just kind of constantly going around and finding all these different threats for different weeks, and sort of almost any kind of political opinion a person could possibly have. There's like an extremist version that Spooks uses as a villain. So they have like lots of radical environmentalists, sort of at least one a season, it seems, because that's, you can sort of insult environmentalists without getting into trouble. That's the kind of thing they do.
Where do you think the television spy genre will go now? I find them particularly difficult to watch, I think, spy genres, both on the big screen and on the little screen, because of the ubiquity of communication devices, which means that people are talking to each other all the time.
That's a very interesting question. I mean, I basically agree with you, and in many ways sort of struggle with a lot of the kind of technologically orientated shows you get nowadays, particularly from America. I think it often feels like the technology is threatening to just overwhelm human agency, but that sometimes kind of attempts to sort of reassert human agency often feel a bit contrived. It's a kind of anxiety in the most recent Bond films, where there's this certainly in Skyfall, there's a whole bit where he first meets Q, and Q's kind of like, yeah, I can, you know, do all the things you do with my technology. And I think there's this kind of underlying anxiety that maybe this is a world where Q is potentially a more powerful figure than Bond. But they, having sort of raised that anxiety, the Bond films sort of trample it down and sort of be like, no, Bond can save the day by shooting people. So don't really kind of follow through on it.
Well, they sort of have to, really, otherwise it's kind of destroyed its kind of purpose, I suppose. I suppose
that, sure.
that's the tension with action cinema, is it's supposed to be people battling against circumstances, and it's very difficult when that's reduced to people pushing buttons.
That's the thing, isn't it? It's very hard to make it's hard to make the computer savvy tech wizard who possibly, you know, could be the protagonist. It's hard to actually kind of convey what they do to a popular audience. I think there's an interview by Stephen Garrett, who was the original executive producer of Spooks and kind of came up with the loose idea, where I think he also worked on The Night Manager. I remember an interview he gave around about that time where he was sort of being like, yeah, we, you know, after all this time, we still haven't really sort of figured out how to kind of do the technological aspect of spying in a way that's sort of dramatic on the screen. I mean, there's all sorts of attempts to kind of play with it. I mean, arguably, the split screen in Spooks and 24 was a sort of, you know, a credible effort to kind of dramatize what surveillance in a visually interesting way. I mean, the technology is always just kind of, you know, leapfrogging ahead. I mean, has any spy fiction really gotten to grips with social media, perhaps, where there's clearly, you know, a lot of surveillance, a lot of potential for surveillance. It's very complicated. Revisiting Spooks recently, part of me thought this is actually fresh and stands up, but part of me couldn't quite imagine a show like that anymore. And I do wonder if there's possibly a lot more anxiety about surveillance, that it's much more heroic depiction of surveillance might seem a bit creepy and unsettling now. In the sort of post-Snowden social media kind of world.
I certainly hope it does. Didn't they do an adaptation of Little Drummer Girl on the BBC recently as well?
Yes.
Le Carré adaptation. And obviously it's set in the past, right? Or it's set whenever it's written, I believe. It removes that technological problem.
Yes, and I wondered if they were going to do that, because Le Carré's big comeback to the screen was The Night Manager, which was done as a novel in 1993, and they did update that one. They did set it in 2016. I haven't seen it for a while, so I can't really remember how the technology impacted on that. But I mean, that was about a human character sort of going undercover in an arms manufacturer's kind of evil empire. So maybe that technology wasn't so much of a factor there. That was about just someone being able to kind of play the part.
When was Night Manager written?
It was published in 1993.
Yeah, so I think the part of the reason why they wouldn't set that in period is because people's fashions were fucking dreadful in 1993. Yet the fashions when Little Drummer Girl set are actually quite chic and look good when they're updated to, you know, where we see them now. I mean, the aesthetics of 1993 are dreadful. I mean, when was Bugs? I can't even remember when Bugs was, but that everything, everyone seems to be wearing kind of like really colourful clothes and things like that. Mm,
yeah.
And it just doesn't look good when you're now. Whereas the 70s fashions of Little Drummer Girl look stylish. That's my theory anyway.
Quite possibly. Because when they announced The Little Drummer Girl and they were like, we're going to do this book, and they didn't actually say whether it was going to be period or not, and because it's, you know, about the Israel-Palestine conflict, part of me just thought, oh, well, you probably could do it now, and you probably could actually make it in one day, which is a sort of sad thought, but they didn't. They did go for that kind of, yeah, that 70s setting. So I thought it was interesting that of these two Le Carré adaptations, they updated one and they set one in the past, and you've outlined some reasons why that might be.
The series that you start looking at, which would be Callan, and the series that you finish looking at, which is Spooks, what would you say the continuity is between those two, and kind of why stop at Spooks?
I mean, I stopped at Spooks in many ways because it was the current show when I started the PhD. And it seemed like it did kind of, as I said before, it does pull together all these threads from earlier shows. There's a certain way in Spooks in which Spooks does actually sort of feel like a kind of revival of an old model, in that, so in the 60s and 70s, you get all these kind of spy shows, which are sort of individual missions, individual cases of the week and so on. So Callan, the Sandbag, a special branch, as I talk about, and lots of other shows are this kind of episodic series form. What I sort of chart in the book is how, in many ways, the most interesting things of the 80s, late 70s and 80s, are these things like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, Edge of Darkness, Bird of Prey, A Very British Coup, these kind of contained serials, which I think kind of, to some extent, supplant the episodic series. And what you get sort of tentatively with Bugs and then more with Spooks is this revival of the episodic series. Spooks seemed a nice place to end, to sort of draw the narrative full circle, and how, in a way, it almost seemed like you'd sort of overcome some of the bigger scale anxieties of Edge of Darkness and into this kind of faith that the secret state can sort out its problems on a weekly basis. It seemed to restore something of an earlier optimism. in many ways, it was a revival, but it's also to some extent the end of the road, I think, because you don't really get those kind of case of the week procedurals in the spy genre now. I think it's in many ways quite hard to imagine them. What you get these days is your things like sort of Bodyguard and Collateral and Killing Eve. We're sort of back firmly into this kind of serial narrative, which I think is often a form for a much more sort of morally uncertain story that can often kind of veer off into all sorts of directions that kind of undercut your certainties about how the world works and isn't so much based on constantly sort of protecting and restoring the status quo. So that's kind of why I ended with Spooks in many ways. It seemed like sort of the climax, a lot of themes, but maybe the end of an era in other ways, and we're in more uncertain times, perhaps.
Joseph, that was great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Joseph Oldham, and his book on the subject, Paranoid Visions, Spies, Conspiracies, and the Secret State in British Television Drama, is now available from Manchester University Press. Thanks for listening. Newton Talks will return.